say something about the eternal spiritual truths of life that often get neglected during our resource pace of life that is being imposed on us by the contemporary lifestyle. So I'll be speaking on the topic of the anxiety epidemic. The anxiety epidemic, are we importing anxiety into our mind and our life? So the stimulus for my choosing this topic was the recent T20 championship that happened in Sri Lanka. So after Sri Lanka lost in the finals, at least two Sri Lankan fans committed suicide. So ostensibly Sri Lanka has been in five finals in the last few years, and then four times they have lost, last four times successively. So that was heartbreaking for the Sri Lankan fans. But it raises the question that is a cricket match or loss in a cricket match worth ending one's own life? And Indians are no less cricket crazy than Sri Lankans. So it could well happen in India also, and it has happened in the past. So what is it? Now, these people are not illiterate villagers from some remote Sinhalese villages. They were young, educated people. So what is it that makes people go so distorted in their priorities and conceptions of life that they are ready to end their lives? So that is the topic I will lead on to, but I lead on to it from the point of view of anxiety. So this is based on, this presentation is primarily based on research in America about anxiety, because America is not just the exporter of technology to the world, it is also the exporter of lifestyle for the rest of the world. And the trends that are there in America are likely to follow India and wherever else American values are imitated. So let's see. Do we have a second mic by any chance? Okay. So while we are there, maybe who would like to read the slides that are there, mostly text? So maybe who would like to read this loudly? Yes, please.
Anxiety epidemic.
Yeah.
Nearly 1 in 5, 40 million American adults suffer from anxiety disorders, the most common class of psychiatric ailment we have. By comparison, a mere 1 in 10 are plagued with mood disorders like depression, the second most common class of psychiatric problems.
Yeah, thank you. Daniel Smith, author of The New Anxiety Memoir. So this person suffered from terrible anxiety and he wrote a memoir called Monkey Mind. So 1 in 5 people suffer from anxiety disorders. There's a difference between anxiety and anxiety disorders. Anxiety is something which all of us may suffer. When we have an exam coming up and we are worried whether I have prepared sufficiently or not, actually we feel anxious. But anxiety disorder refers to a constant chronic state of anxiety. Will I be able to catch the bus or not? Will I be able to reach a shop or reach the office on time or not? Have I carried my ID and my wallet and my other things with me or not? So every single thing that we do, or a large number of things that we do, when there is anxiety within that, that is an anxiety disorder. So here we are talking about anxiety. That is a natural human emotion which is created by the unpredictability of life. And that needs to be dealt with. We are talking here of something much, much, much more insidious, much, much more dangerous. That is an anxiety disorder. So, 1 in 5 people suffer from an anxiety disorder. And 1 in 10 suffer from depression, which is again another mental problem itself. And we will see later how the two are related. Yes, who else would like to read? Yes, please.
According to the 2002 World Mental Health Survey, people in developing world countries such as Nigeria are up to 5 times less likely to show clinical significant anxiety levels than Americans, despite having more basic life necessities to worry about. What's more, when these less anxious developing world citizens immigrate to the United States, they tend to get just as anxious as Americans. Taylor Clark, author of NERVE.
Thank you. So, we may say that, oh, people will be anxious because they don't know where they will get their roti kapda makan. But paradoxically, what the World Mental Health Survey is showing is that people have more anxiety not because they have their basic necessities to worry about. That those who have basic necessities to worry about have less anxiety. Those who have some other worries, they get into anxiety disorders. And these people, when they go to America, they also develop these anxiety disorders. So as this put over there in the title, America is the world anxiety champion. That is a very dubious distinction to have. So then, if the anxiety is not about, as we say, the basic necessity is roti kapda makan, then what causes this anxiety? So normally speaking, almost all of us have anxiety about our career. Will I get a good job? Will I have longevity in my job? Will my boss fire me? Will I be able to have a good career? So one of the most common causes of anxiety is lack of financial security. So is this the cause behind the anxiety? Is anxiety caused by the state of the economy, that when there is a recession, then that's when the economy, that's when people have anxiety? That's, yes? Yeah, please.
Is anxiety caused by the state of the economy? No, even when the economy were in great shape as of 2004, Americans spent $2.1 billion on anti-anxiety medicines, almost double the amount spent in 1997.
Oh, thank you. So, $2.1 billion. Huge amount, isn't it? Astronomical, and this is on anti-anxiety medicines. So it's a whole field. Actually speaking, how much anti-anxiety medicines work is also questionable. We will discuss that a little later, because it is based on, these medicines have varieties of mechanisms, but the essential mechanism is that the idea is there are certain chemicals that are secreted in the brain when we have certain emotions. So, anti-anxiety medicines try to suppress the formation of those chemicals or counter the formation of those chemicals. And in this way, suppress means we don't allow them to be formed. Counter means after they are formed, we send in some other chemicals which by reaction remove those chemicals. And that's the way they think anxiety can be removed. But is this really the way to deal with anxiety? Because after all, if I feel hungry, you know, so there is a actual cause for that, that emptiness in the stomach that I feel, isn't it? That is, my body needs food. So actually, if when I feel hungry and I start feeling some sort of sensations in my stomach and my neck, if at that time I send chemicals inside which actually cut off those sensations, what will happen? It's not that my hunger is gone away. It's just that the sensations have been cut off. That's not really the way to deal with anxiety, with hunger. So yes, everything that we do, it will have some chemical effect. So the other side of medicines which we had tried earlier in neuroscience. Neuroscience is the study of the neural circuitry in the brain. That is the study of the brain, to put simply. So in neuroscience they thought that happiness corresponds to the presence of certain chemicals in the brain. So whenever I feel happy, so they find that there are certain chemicals in the brain. So then maybe 15-20 years ago, the hope was there that we could in future make a happiness pill or a happiness injection. Whenever you want to feel happy, you just take a pill or put an injection, those chemicals will get secreted in your brain, you'll become happy. So easy. Does it really work like that? No. If happiness was so simple, then everybody would have become happy. The problem is that here the cause and the symptom are being confused. To explain this in a simpler way, for example, when I am happy, I will smile. But suppose without my happiness, somebody wants to, without my being internally happy, if somebody brings a face twisting machine and twist the face muscles on my face so that there is a smile on my face. Now, okay, the smile is not the cause of happiness. The smile is the symptom of happiness. So happiness is an internal state which gets expressed as a smile. So just as this happens at a physical level, the same happens at a mental level. So internally I feel happy, and accordingly the chemicals are secreted in the brain, and accordingly certain expressions are formed on the face. Similarly, internally I feel anxious. That leads to secretion of certain chemicals in the brain, and that leads to certain physical symptoms. Maybe I'll start trembling, or I'll start sweating, or I'll start palpitating, whatever. So the point here is, this approach is not very effective in dealing with anxiety. But nonetheless, this approach has been used to an extent that $2.1 billion are spent on it. So that does indicate that anxiety is a serious problem, not just in terms of number of people suffering from it, but the amount of money spent on it. And we know that in 2008 onwards, there was this big recession. So I wrote a book on that topic of recession, adversity or opportunity at that time, explaining how the recession was actually caused by wanton lifestyles. But essentially, even when the economy was good, the anxiety was worse. So what exactly is the cause of the anxiety? So we can recite this verse from the Bhagavad Gita. The 16th chapter is called the divine and demoniac natures, the godly and ungodly natures. So Krishna describes here the cause of anxiety in 16.11. Chintama parimeyam cha, parimeyam cha, pralayantam upashitaha, pralayantam upashitaha, kamopabhoga parama, kamopabhoga parama, etavaditi nishchitaha. So, would anyone like to read the translation? Yes.
They believe that to gratify the senses is the prime necessity of human civilization. Thus, until the end of life, their anxiety is immeasurable.
Yes. So, the Sanskrit, thank you. Sanskrit is simple here. Chinta is anxiety. And aparimeyam is immeasurable. So, it is caused by kama pabhoga parama, by the desire to enjoy material things. So let us, as Prabhupada translates that, to gratify the senses. Hare Krishna, can we have a little silence? You can go out and talk if you have to talk on the cell phone. So, pralayanta upashitaha. So now, it's interesting, there are various causes of anxiety. So here we look at the first cause. According to psychologists, it is the anxiety of choice. Who would like to read this? Anyone else who has not read till now, then we can come to you again. Yes, please.
Standard psychology professor Hazel Marcus asked Indian and American participants to report how many choices they had made by doing a series of small tasks. So everybody made the same series of decisions, choosing a desk to sit at, choosing a pad to use, choosing whether or not free camping.
So honored to see you. Puji, you would like to speak?
No, I came to hear.
Oh no.
Please. Sorry to disturb.
Oh. You're here for a few days? Or? You came today itself? You came
just came today.
Oh, I'm honored to meet you. I hope I can have your sangha sometime.
Please continue. We'll play what's up later.
Yes, thank you. So,
we have a very esteemed guest with us. We have His Grace Ananta Mahaprabhu. He is the International Communications Director for ISKCON. So, he travels all over the world helping ISKCON communities to develop proper relationships with the broader social circle around. So, he's one of my spiritual teacher, so today he has come to assess a student, and I hope that I can please him also. So we are discussing today on the topic of the anxiety epidemic. So I gave some statistics about how much anxiety is troubling so many people, and now we are discussing the causes. Please feel free to comment whenever you feel appropriate. Thank you. Yes, so here we go.
Yeah, please.
Standard psychology professor Hazel Marcus asked Indian and American participants to report how many choices they had made by doing a series of small tasks. So everybody made the same series of decisions, choosing a desk to sit at, choosing a card to use, choosing whether or not to eat free candy.
So I hope this is clear. Both of them were asked the same things, but they were asked how many choices did you make? Yeah.
Americans thought that they had made twice as many choices as the Indians, 20 compared to 10. Too much choices can paralyze people and make them anxious.
Yes. So now how is it possible that when doing the same activities, different people feel that they have made different choices? So for example, now you're coming sit, you're sitting for the class. So now one choice is whether you sit in the first row or the last row. So now some of us may make this choice consciously. We decide, okay, I want to be attentive. And then we'll come in the front. Some of us may make it unconsciously, okay, wherever there's place, let's be sit that. So the consequence of the modern materialistic lifestyle is that many times trivial issues become matters of serious choice. For example, if I had to brush my teeth, I need a toothpaste. So now it's just a functional need. But if we go to a supermarket, there'll be 25 brands of toothpastes. And then I have an anxiety, which one to choose? Or for that matter, especially what may be more common nowadays is, if I have to use a cell phone. There are so many different companies with so many different schemes. Then this scheme has this advantage, but it does not have that advantage. This scheme has this problem, that scheme doesn't have that problem, but it has some other problem. And I know one devotee friend who spent 3 months just trying to decide which cell phone scheme to use. And worst of all, they compared these two people. They are called there's another professor who did the research. These are called as two kinds of people, optimizers and pragmatists. So the optimizers are people who try in every single decision to make the right choice. If I had to purchase a shirt, okay, I will choose practically everything that is there and then I will decide to choose the shirt. So they are the optimizers. The pragmatists are, they spend a certain amount of time choosing and then they decide, okay, I'll take this, that's it, over. So, in general, what the survey found is that the optimizers often got a better deal. That generally they would get more value for their money because they spend more time in doing the research. Whereas the pragmatists did not get so much value for their money. But emotionally, the optimizers still had a far greater sense of regret and anxiety. Maybe if I had done some more research, I might have found a better choice. So, end result, we might get a better material product, but what about the emotional price that we pay? So basically, when our choices get expanded too much, then that leads to anxiety. Certainly at one level, choice is a sign of freedom. But actually when too much of our mental energy goes into choosing, then that leads to anxiety. Let's recite another verse from Bhagavad Gita, this is 16:16. It's one part of the verse. Aneka chitta vibhranta moha jala samavrita. So Krishna is telling over here, vibhranta. Bhranta means to be distracted. Vibhranta means these vishesh, special, excessively distracted. So when a person is excessively distracted by various choices, then what happens? Moha jala samavritaha. Such a person gets completely enmeshed, trapped in illusion, in the network of illusions and anxieties that result from it. So the materialistic society increases our sense of freedom by giving us a lot of choices. But in that, we often end up going through much, much greater anxiety about trivial issues. Let's see how.
Yes, who would like to read this? Yes, please.
Anything about the decision that is less than perfect is a review to the decision maker. Having author of the paradox of choice, why more is less?
Yes. So, when a society is oriented around fashion and status, then everything that a person does, it is seen not only as a functional decision, but as an identity decision. It becomes a statement about the person. So this is not so much there in traditional societies, because externals are not given so much value. Whereas in modern society, every single thing, okay, how do you have your hairstyle? You comb your hair this way or that way, you have curly hair or straight hair, and whether you keep a beard and moustache, or you keep only a beard and not a moustache, if you keep only a moustache and not a beard, then what kind of moustache you keep? So all these things are seen as statements of identity, statements of fashion and status. And so the problem with this is that social values keep changing. So what might be a hairstyle that we consider fashionable today, after 1 month, it will be out of fashion. And then constantly people are anxiety. Is what I am doing the right thing or not? That's why here is it. Why more is less? When there are more choices, actually it ends up leading to we having less peace of mind, less freedom. So going to the same point, yes, Barry Schwartz writes in his book. Who would like to read? Yes. Becomes a statement about us, or the world sees it as a statement about us. Now, to some extent, it is true. It is going to happen. But when there is a traditional society or traditional values in society, then people don't go so much by extremes. So, I'll start from an extreme. Then we are in Brahmacharya life, all of us have the same dress. So, there is no question of anxiety about this. All of us have the same hairstyle. No hair. So again, there is no anxiety. Now, this may be an extreme, but in general, when people have followed the value of simple living and high thinking, then the externals don't occupy so much of the mental energy. So, when there is no simple living and high thinking, actually speaking, there is only simply living and no thinking. Simply living and no thinking. Why? Because all the thinking is about living. Should I wear this dress? Should I wear this shirt? Should I put on this kind of spectacles? So this leads to so much anxiety. So much of our anxiety is really caused by fashion and status. So we talk about choice. Now from choice we are going to fashion and status. So first is just choice. Okay, there are so many things to choose. What I will choose. But then what I choose will speak about my identity. It will be a statement about me, and that causes further anxiety. So this conception of status is talked about by Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Ishvaro mamam bhogi, siddham balvan sukhi, siddham balvan sukhi, adyo vijanvan asmi, adyo vijanvan asmi, kovanyasti sadrishomaya, kovanyasti sadrishomaya. So Lord Krishna is saying, Ishvaro mamam bhogi, I am the Lord, I am the enjoyer, I am perfect, I am strong, I am happy, and I am surrounded by all admirable people. Who is there like me? So this is the typical modern mentality. I saw the advertisement for a car. It said that purchase this car and enjoy the envy in your neighbor's eyes.
So now, is envy an emotion to be enjoyed?
But the values are so fleeting, and what will happen? If your neighbor purchases that car, then he will enjoy the
difference. So it essentially will cause people to burn. So it's such a negative centered way of living. And actually, if you look at the Vedic literature, one of the simple anxiety and dissatisfaction that results from anxiety is Duryodhana. Now Duryodhana in the Mahabharata had enormous amount of wealth. But when he went to the Pandava sacrifice and he saw that they had got far greater wealth, then he was burning so much with envy, frustration and anxiety about how he will get the wealth. So Dhritarashtra was relatively more sober-minded. And he, when Shakuni told about his anxiety, he said, your son is burning with anxiety and lamentation. So what is the cause? And Duryodhana said, what man can be happy when his enemies are enjoying more than him? So Dhritarashtra told him, my dear son, why do you bother about the Pandavas? You have huge palaces. You have a beautiful queen. You have admiring citizens. You have glorious chariots. All that you want for enjoyment, all that ordinary people dream about, you have that. He said, it doesn't matter. The Pandavas have more than me. What? He was so insecure because the Pandavas were better than him. And that's how he arranged for the whole grid gambling match in which Draupadi was disrobed and the Pandavas were dispossessed and killed. But the worst part of it was that even after the Pandavas were exiled, still he was not satisfied. He had two anxieties. First anxiety was understandable. And after the period of exile, when they come back, then there is going to be a war. So he had, even when the condition was made that after 12 years exile and 1 year in existence in anonymity, then after that they will have to give back the kingdom. He had no intention of giving the kingdom back. But still he was thinking, then they will come back. And not only that anxiety, he was thinking, I have sent the Pandavas to the forest. Are they miserable about in the forest? So he wouldn't enjoy, even when he had better enjoyment than the better material enjoyment in the Pandavas. He felt, my enjoyment has to come from their misery. And then he decided, I will go to the forest. The Pandavas were staying in Kamyavan. And he said, I will go to the forest and flaunt my wealth in front of them. So now Dhritarashtra was quite fearful. He said, the Pandavas are like enraged serpents now. Don't aggravate them any further. So he knew that his father would not allow him to go. So he came up with some other excuse. He said, we have got our shepherds over there. And we have to go and supervise the shepherds and see the whether the sheep are proper or not, how much wool they have got. So I will go there and I will come there. Dhritarashtra said, the Pandavas and they don't go there. He says, no, I will not go anywhere near the Pandavas, don't worry. So then he got the pretext and he came out. And when he came to the Kamyavan, the Pandavas were on one side of the river. There, now Yudhishthir had accepted his fate. And he was living in the forest, performing sacrifices, having spiritual discussions with the sages, and actually was quite happy. Certainly, as a king, he felt his duty to take care of his citizens, and he knew that he would have to go back and do that. But he accepted his condition, he was happy. But Duryodhana, despite having all the wealth, was not happy. And he came there to flaunt his wealth. So he brought his chariots, and his crowns, and his ornaments, and his maidservants, and his queen. And he was on the other side of the river. Deliberately he came. Now the river was not very big, so it could be seen what was happening on the other side of the river. And he started flaunting his wealth. And he is hoping that the Pandavas will see this and they will burn in envy. And then I will enjoy the envy in their eyes. That was this. So the modern entire industry is actually impelling all of us to become like Duryodhana. To enjoy the envy in others' eyes. But unfortunately, or fortunately, there were higher forces involved. So, at that place, some Gandharvas were sporting and they told Duryodhana, that Duryodhana's soldiers, he says, this is the area of the Gandharvas, get out of here, otherwise you will be killed. So, Duryodhana was very arrogant. He was thinking that, I am the king of the earth. Who are these Gandharvas? He says, this whole earth is my property. You get out of here. So the Gandharvas laughed. They said, "We take orders from only one master." He said, "You get out of here or you'll be killed." And then he was very proud of his prowess also. So he said, "Attack!" And he attacked, and the Gandharvas just effortlessly destroyed all the soldiers. Then he picked up his bow, and Karna was there, and Dushyasana was there, Shakuni was there. All of them started fighting. And his Gandharva was Chitrangada. So Chitrangada. So he had his Gandharva soldiers fighting. When they were slowly overpowered, he picked up his weapons and he targeted Karna. And Karna couldn't counter his attack. Finally, Karna became tormented, fled from there. Fled from there completely. And then all the soldiers, Shakuni fled, Dushyasana got wounded, he fled. Only Duryodhana was left. He fought ferociously. He was infuriated that his army had been defeated. But his fury was no substitute for his skill. And the Gandharva overpowered him and arrested him. And you know, Duryodhana had his egoistic mentality. All his maidservants and queen, they were watching. He thought, "I will show my heroism." But the worst thing that happened to him was that he was defeated, shackled like an animal in front of his group. And he felt so mortified. So some of the soldiers who were there fighting on the side of Duryodhana, they ran across the river. And they told Yudhishthira, "Please, you know, your cousin King Duryodhana has been arrested by the Gandharvas. Our Kuru ladies, they have been taken into imprisonment by the Gandharvas. Please, save them." So when Bhima heard this, he started laughing. He said, "It seems still there are some gods who want to do some good to us." So he said that what we have had to do after great labor after 13 years, the gods have done today itself. Duryodhana has got what he deserves. He started laughing. Yudhishthira said, "Oh Bhima, don't think like this. For the world, for our among us, we will be 100 versus 5. But for the world, we are 105. We are one family. And the Kuru ladies are members of our family. It is insult to the honor of the Kuru dynasty that our ladies have been arrested." So Bhima was not interested in this thing. So then Yudhishthira was very intelligent. So then Yudhishthira told Bhima that, "Bhima, your worst enemy today depends on your mercy for his freedom and his life. You know, what greater joy can you get than freeing your worst enemy and giving him mercy?" So Bhima said, "This makes sense." So the Pandavas have their individual personality, and although Bhima is also transcendental, he embodies the quintessential Kshatriya spirit. And then they went across. So Yudhishthira said, "I myself have gone, but I am sitting for the sacrifice." So he went across. He said, "Bhima and Arjuna, you go." So Arjuna went, and Arjuna single-handedly fought with the Gandharvas. He fought with Chitraratha and defeated him. And then at that time, when Chitraratha was nearly getting defeated, he raised his hand. He said, "Arjuna, I am your friend. We have met long ago." And he said, "Yeah, but you have attacked our family members. You are not our friend." He said, No. He said, "Listen, actually, I was sent by Indra. Indra knew about the vicious intentions of Duryodhana. He wanted to flaunt his wealth in front of you and humiliate you by that." Now, all this was spoken with Duryodhana's earshot. And Duryodhana felt all the more mortified by that. And he said, "So that's why Indra sent me to humiliate this arrogant brat. He has dishonored your wife, he has dispossessed you, he deserves to be killed." So he said, "No, let us go to Yudhishthira and ask him what to do." So fine. Then they took him to Yudhishthira, and Yudhishthira heard the whole story. Yudhishthira offered his respects to Chitra, to the Gandharva, and he said, "I am grateful to you that although you had the power, you did not kill any of our family members. So if you would like to do us any good, please release me." So the Gandharva king said that your nobility is extraordinary, that even after hearing the vicious motives of Duryodhana, you still want to release him. So then Duryodhana was released, and as Duryodhana was released, his Kshatriya honor was completely shattered. And Yudhishthira had a very kind heart, but even he spoke, "Oh child, don't do naughty things like this again in the future." And this incensed like a giant, you think I'm the king of the world, I'm a giant. Well, he was acting childishly. Sometimes, you know, some children have, one child has one toy, another child has another toy. And the child wants to, my toy is better than yours. So it was just a childlike mentality. So Duryodhana fit, so enriched. And then he saw the Kshatriya on the side. Oh Arjuna, you have done a favor to me. And I would like to do something for you in return. Ask what you would like.
So, Arjuna was laughing at the thought. He says, we just spared you your life. He said, I don't need anything right now. In the future, if I need, I will ask. So, we know later on, when Bhishma had taken the vow to kill the five arrows, he used that.
So, then when Duryodhana came back, he was so mortified. His just brain couldn't work. Then he, Dushyasana came there and asked, to add anxiety, add insult to injury, Karna came back. He had, whose wounds had been nursed, and he said, oh Duryodhana, it is amazing that you single-handedly defeated the Gandharvas. That I wouldn't do that, but you did that. Your promise is so great. I am amazed to see your promise. And Duryodhana couldn't even look in his eyes. And Dushyasana tell him what happened. And then he told Dushyasana told him, and then finally Duryodhana said, you know, I cannot tolerate this anxiety. Insult, he said. Dushyasana, you go back. You become the prince regent, you become the king. I am going to commit suicide. I am going to fast in this forest to death. Shakuni said, what is this? He says, you should not fast. He says, even great kings, they face reversals in their life. He says, this is not a reversal, this is a disaster. I came to humiliate my enemies, but I got humiliated in their eyes. How can I live with such humiliation? So practically he sat down to fast to death over there. It's a long story about why he gave that fasting. He got some mystical vision where the Danavas came to him and told him that actually you are our agent on this earth and we are going to do wonderful things through you. Don't let this calamity dissuade you. Arise and fight and then we will help you. So because of that he gave, but he practically came to suicide. So the point here is that what caused anxiety? It was when a person doesn't have any sense of self-identity and self-worth that comes from within, from what he is. Duryodhana's whole sense of self-worth came from a comparison with the Pandavas. And he was thinking, only when I am better than him. So that can go, is my dress better than him? Is my bike better than somebody else's? Is my car better than somebody else's? Is my house bigger than somebody else's? Is my wife more good looking than somebody else's? So it can go on to anything. So far from the women's point of view, is my husband earning more than her husband? So there are so many issues where our sense of self-identity comes from externals. Then we court perpetual anxiety. So here what is being taught, what is learned through statistics, that is actually depicted in the Mahabharata. So it's not a question of whether one has more wealth or less wealth. When Duryodhana had less wealth than the Pandavas, he was miserable. He was anxious and felt wretched. Even when he had more wealth than the Pandavas, still he felt anxious, miserable and wretched. So, it is not a question of what we have. It is a question of what is our sense of identity. Where do we think our sense of identity is coming from? So, we now look at solutions over here. So actually the whole modern lifestyle can be expressed in these three words. WWS. You know, people now, most of us have so much work. 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours. And after we come back from office, we think, I'm so tired, I need some relief. So what do? Sit down, turn on the television. And in the television, there may be various programs, but the most carefully arranged part of television programs are the advertisements, the commercials. Sometimes for a few seconds, millions of rupees are spent. So what happens is, and what exactly are advertisements? Advertisements are basically telling us, your hairstyle is wrong. Your shirt is wrong. Your cell phone is wrong. Your bike is wrong. Change it. That's what is being told. Your watch. No, this is not right watch. Take that watch. So all the advertisements are focused on creating needs. And most of the time, if we don't have it, we feel I need it. If we have it, I feel I need something better. So what happens when we watch? Then we shop, go and purchase. There are several surveys which show that these are three main activities that consume people's time. Either their work, and all the time that is there apart from work, the two main activities are watching and shopping. So now, when I watch, oh, this my shoes are wrong, my shirt is wrong, then let me go and shop. And when I go to shop, see, in the past, if you see in India, there would be these kirana shops, where I go with a shopping list. I just tell this, give me this, give me this, give me this, and I get it. But now there are these supermarkets, where there are malls. And when there are malls, apart from what I want to purchase, there are so many other things that I see. So what happens? Dhyayato vishayan pumsa sangasteishu pajayate. Krishna says, whatever we contemplate on, desires come for that. And the supermarket means super illusion. So, I want this also, I want this also. I can't carry it, no problem. We will give you a card to carry things. And then, oh, I don't have so much money, no problem. We'll give credit cards. And people purchase so many things which they don't need. In fact, there was I wrote about a form of addiction which is as bad as alcoholism. That is called as shopaholism. Shopaholism means people are addicted to shopping. So there is a book on that topic called You Are What You Shop. That means you purchase this. Whether we need it or not doesn't matter. Just that anxiety, I have to purchase. So shop till you drop. It is like that. People have so much anxiety. So now naturally, when I shop something, it doesn't come free. So even if it is by credit cards, I have to pay for it. So then what happens? I work more. So then when I work more, I feel more exhausted. I feel more in need of relief. So then I come back and watch more TV. And when I watch more TV, I get more desire. But I shop more. So in this way, it becomes a vicious cycle. So, work, watch, shop, WWS, that is worldwide stupidity. It's worldwide stupidity, that's unfortunate. So, this is the culture that is coming to us and it is going to cause us tremendous anxiety. So, if we buy into this culture, we can't just buy into the culture without the anxiety. We will get the anxiety. So, if you want to avoid this, then we have to avoid this whole syndrome of watching and shopping which generates all the desires. Second one. So, the second part is, we are seeking identity, shelter and pleasure. All of us have to seek these things somewhere. Who am I? When I am stressed, what do I think about? What do I do to get relief from stress? That is shelter. And where do I get enjoyment? So, when we seek identity, shelter and pleasure in materialistic things, then all three cause anxiety for us. All three cause anxiety for us. So we need to actually turn towards spirituality. When I understand I am a spiritual person, actually I don't need any of these things for my happiness. What I need is inner fulfillment, inner enrichment. And that comes by my devotional relationship with Krishna. So when we chant the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, it is not just some religious ritual that we make. It is actually a means for inner enrichment. It is a means for experiencing a deeper inner satisfaction. And by chanting, by contemplating on Krishna, by studying the Bhagavad Gita, we understand our spiritual identity. We realize our spiritual identity. And then we understand, oh, these things don't matter so much. These things are not all that important. Yes, we still have our material lives, we have our careers, and we have to be able to pursue our careers. But we don't get our mental energy locked and blocked in trivial things. So if we let our mental energy get locked and blocked in trivial things, then we can't even function materially. What to speak of spiritual? You know, Bangalore is the most developed software city in practically the whole world. In fact, in the English language, a new word came by the Avenger last time called Bangalore. You know what is Bangalore? There's a verb called Bangalore, is a noun. But the word Bangalore is also a word. So what does it mean? It means that suppose a person in America says, I was Bangalore. What does it mean? That the job which I had, it was outsourced to Bangalore, so I lost my job. So I was Bangalore. So Bangalore means outsourced, a job that is outsourced, and so the person gets unemployed. So Bangalore is a leading software city in India and possibly among the world, leading software cities of the world. But unfortunately, Bangalore also has. It's like the world's suicide capital. Maximum number of people are committing suicide there. Why? Because of excessive materialism. You see, from the West, the money is coming in. So from software industry, people earn a lot. But then, the culture is coming. And that culture creates enormous anxiety. So as devotees, or as those who are trying to be devotees, it is not just that we are practicing some religious rituals. What we are practicing, what we are learning and practicing, is going to equip us to even face the assaults of anxiety and turbulence that are going to come in the material society. So at one level, spirituality can steady and ease even our material journey. Of course, Rayana level, we want to go beyond the material journey to the spiritual journey. We want to develop our eternal life in relationship with Krishna and go back to Krishna. So that is our ultimate goal. But while pursuing that goal, spirituality doesn't tell us to neglect the material life. Actually, we will be better equipped to even face the material life. Otherwise, we will become completely disoriented. So, in India, it is not that people are free from anxiety. Everybody, everywhere in the material world, there is anxiety. This material world is called as Kunta. Spiritual world is called as Vaikunta. Vaikunta means the place free from anxiety. Kunta means the place where there is anxiety. But still, the extent of our anxiety will depend on the extent of our materialism. So when we balance between materialism and spirituality, when we get our sense of identity, our shelter and our pleasure, through devotional activities. That means I understand, I am a soul. So whether I am travelling in a big car or I am travelling in a crowded bus, it doesn't really matter. That doesn't define who I am. I am a soul. And sometimes I may travel in a car, sometimes I travel in a bus, sometimes I travel in a plane. That doesn't change who I am. I remain the same. If I think that I am the car, then what is going to happen? When somehow the car goes away, I am going to be miserable. So when we get our sense of identity in spiritual knowledge, we get our shelter. So all of us will have to work in our offices, in our colleges, wherever we are, and that will create some stress. But instead of seeking the relief in television, which is only going to agitate us more, we seek it in Krishna. Okay, let me come and hear some spiritual wisdom. Let me hear some nice soothing kirtans. Let me chant Krishna's holy names. When we get shelter over there, then we will not be feeding anxiety, we will be drawing anxiety out of our system. And pleasure. See, all of us are pleasure seeking. And spirituality doesn't tell us give up the pleasure. Just connect with the pleasure in a way that it will last forever. So that is spirituality. So when we chant and dance in kirtans, we take darshan of the beautiful deities, we honor Krishna Prasad, all this actually makes us happier in a far deeper and a far greater sense than what dancing to material music or just watching some material movies, these things can give us happiness. So spirituality is not about rejecting material life, but it is about redirecting our sense of identity, shelter and pleasure so that we don't get ourselves unduly affected, even devastated by the onslaught of materialism that is being brought upon us through the contemporary culture. So I'll summarize what we discussed, then we can have some questions. I started by talking about how people commit suicide. So some cricket fans committed suicide because their country cricket team lost the World Cup. So what had happened for them? Their sense of identity, shelter, pleasure came from cricket. Oh, what is the use of my life if my country is not the world champion? Even if your country becomes the world champion, what is the practical difference that is going to happen to you? what practical difference? Okay, you just dance in the streets for a few hours and then strike your collar, my country is the world champion. But what practical difference is it going to make? But no, our sense of identity gets locked in such artificial things that we can't tolerate a loss. So we discussed that how uncontrolled emotions can take people even to suicide. And then we discussed how anxiety disorder is different from anxiety. It's perpetual anxiety. And 1 out of 5 people in America are suffering from it. 1 out of 10 people in America are suffering from depression. Then we discussed it's not finances that causes anxiety. We discussed the anxiety of choice, the anxiety due to status and fashions. And then we discussed the Lumbha Vida verses. So we talked about if we wish to stop anxiety, then our sense of identity shelter pleasure. It doesn't have to come from something else. Comparison with others, as it happened to the Lumbha. Discussed lavishly as an example. And it has to come from within in our relationship with Krishna. Otherwise, we have this WWS. That's how our whole life will go on. What is WWS?
World
Wide Web. Yeah, what is that? That is the ultimate acronym. What are they doing?
Work, watch, and
yes, work, watch, shop. That's what material life is all about. And actually, there is no happiness in that. There is only anxiety. So, Krishna consciousness doesn't mean that we will give up our material life. But it means that we can be in material life without courting all the anxiety and turbulence that the material life brings. And also along with that, we can have a spiritual journey that gives us eternal happiness. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Ready to commence? Thank you. Feel free to ask whatever questions, either related to this topic or any general philosophical questions you do. Yes, please.
Harishma Prabhuji, I am from advertising agency. So, what should I do? Should I do my job or?
Okay, that's a candid question. What should I do if I'm an advertising company? See, there are the activities that we do, they fall in 3 broad categories: devotional, non-devotional, and anti-devotional. So, it's like if you have white, black, and in between is a spectrum of gray. So, for example, hearing, chanting, worshiping the deities, studying scriptures, they are white, they are directly spiritual activities. And then there are anti-devotional activities. Those are the activities which involve breaking the 4 regular principles. So, for example, the advertisement is about, say, alcohol, or it's about meat. Then those are anti-devotional. And they should be given up. But if it's in the spectrum of gray, they're not directly anti-devotional, they're non-devotional. So some of them will be more non-devotional than others. So generally speaking, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 8th chapter, Sarva-arambha-hi-doshena-dhune-na-dhune-bhavata. He says that Sarva-arambha, all activities, hi-doshena, they have fault. He gives the example, dhune-arambha-hi-bhavata. Just as fire is covered, Agni is covered by avruta by dhumen, smoke. This says fire is covered by smoke. So in the material life, we cannot avoid the damnations in our work. So that's why if it is not explicitly anti-devotional, then there is no need for us to give that up. At the same time, we can also, if we have learned certain talents for marketing, we can use them in Krishna's service. Because at one level, the material life is going to teach you certain skills which you can use for other purposes also. So we can use the marketing advertising skills to share Krishna's message with the world, to help devotees share that message with the world. So we don't have to worry too much about the specifics of the profession. Because if it is not anti-devotional, then we don't have to give it up. What the greater consideration would be while deciding our profession is how much time does it take? So if it is going to take too much time, then it doesn't leave us adequate time for practicing devotional service. Then maybe we may have to think either sooner or later, we shift over to a career which allows us more time. Many times devotees, if they have the inclination, the capability, then they often try to go towards teaching jobs. So teaching is possible in every field. You can even teach advertisement, you can teach engineering, you can teach marketing, or whatever skills we have. So teaching is a relatively subcommodity job. Even a subject is not subcommodity. But that is a possibility. So one equivalent of teaching would be concentration. So in the future one can do that. Then one has more freedom, relatively speaking. So essentially, when we are choosing our jobs, The first criteria of permission should not be ended emotionally. But apart from that, the other criteria is how much time is it going to demand? Another criteria is it going to take us away from devotee association? So if it involves frequent traveling, or if it involves Hare Krishna, can you hear me? Yeah, so if it involves us having to physically relocate away from devotee circle, so send me to some place where there is no devotee association available, then as much as possible we should try to avoid it. Because then without association of devotees, it's very difficult to practice spiritual life. So the amount of time available, the facility for devotional service that is provided, this is the primary criteria apart from the anti-devotional job. So within the spectrum of grey, this is what we can use to decide where we choose. And naturally, it is not that Krishna consciousness is against earning money. If a job pays us more, there is nothing wrong in taking that job. It's good because then we can be more financially stable. But in the name of financial stability, we should not let all our time be taken away by a job, or let the association of devotees be lost in the pursuit of a job. With you? Any other questions? Okay, what is the exact meaning of moksha? Before that, you would like to comment on something in this answer?
No, it's a great answer. Especially that he has calendars for advertising.
Is it in this question? Yeah.
No, sir, I endorse your answer, and especially the idea that the talents we have we should use in Krishna service.
Okay. The talents we can use it. So, you know, we have this ISKCON website called news.iskcon.com, iskcon.news.com. So, Prabhuji is the international editor for that website. So, then you can help you with that also. So, regarding moksha, whereas Krishna uses the word moksha in Bhagavad Gita also, Shubha Shubha Phala Yadevam Mokshise Karma Bandhane Sanyasa Yoga Yuktatma Vimuktomam Paishyasi. So he uses this word in the Bhagavad Gita in 9.28. So he's describing, first he describes moksha and then he describes vimukti. So mukti and vishesha vimukti. So generally speaking, that people think of moksha as a sense state of inactivity and disentanglement. I don't do any activity in life and I'm not entangled with anything. That is a valid understanding of moksha. But that is not a complete understanding. So moksha just doesn't mean, for example, say, if somebody is too mad for sports, every time there's a sports match, the person is caught up in that. So then for that person, moksha would be, okay, I'll not be attached to this particular sport. But I don't have all the anxiety. So that is a negative centric understanding of liberation. Okay, there is this world which causes me suffering. I just want to be free from that. That is one level of moksha. Freedom from that which causes anxiety and suffering. But after that, what do I do? Okay, I don't watch sports, I don't get entangled in sports, but I have to do something in my life. So what do I do? So there is positive activity. There are positive relationships. So if we consider this as the y-axis, materialistic activities are on the negative axis. Inactivity and disentanglement is at the zero point. But devotional activity and devotional relationships are on the positive axis. So what we try to do is, we develop relationship with devotees, ultimately develop relationship with Krishna. And yes, many people think that the idea of moksha is there is a white light and you have to merge into that light. So devotees have no urge to merge. Why? Because they know that there is something beyond that light. Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita 14.26, Brahmano hi pratishtaham amritasya yasya shashvatasya dharmasya sukasya yantikasya cha. He describes that there is this Brahman which is the white light, but hi pratishtaham, I am the support of that Brahman. That means I am beyond that Brahman. So that means just like we have all pervading sunlight, but the sunlight is coming from the source, that is the sun. So like that, there is all pervading Brahman. So many people think moksha is to enter into that Brahman. just enter into that light and merge into that light. Sometimes you may see some movies and things like that also. Some religious movies. So you go into that light. But actually, beyond that light, there is a kingdom of God. And there, you and I, each of us have our own individual identity. And there we can relate with Krishna. And what is the difference between that life and this life? There is no mortality and there is no misery. There is no death over there and there is no suffering over there. So that, attaining that spiritual abode of Krishna is the highest understanding of liberation. And Krishna calls it Mukto Maam Upaishyasi. When you become Mukta, he doesn't become He. Krishna says Maam Upaishyasi. He attains me. So that is the liberation that we can attain by the process of devotional service. So in devotional service, we do two things simultaneously. One is, we not only give up our material attachments, but we simultaneously develop our spiritual attachments. So it's not that, okay, I will not look at beautiful things. I will not eat delicious things. No. I will not look at worldly beautiful things, but I look at the beautiful form of Krishna. I will not just, okay, I will not eat materialistic things, but I will eat delicious Krishna prasad. So it's a much easier way of attaining mukti. So the Bhagavatam describes why it is easier. So describing that some people who try to attain moksha by riktamatayo. Matti means consciousness. So they try to empty their consciousness. Don't think of this, don't think of that, don't think of that, don't think of that. These are all materialistic, but this is very difficult. Riktamatayo. Why? Srodoganas. Like these material desires and material thoughts, they come in like waves on the coast of ocean. How can we stop the waves from coming? But instead of that, a devotee just doesn't say, no, empty the mind. Just fill the mind with service to Krishna. Delight in the lotus feet of Krishna. Vilasa bhaktya. Then very easily one can attain moksha. Amarana bhajavasudevam. Worship Lord Vasudev. And that's the, when you're practicing bhakti. So actually speaking, what we are doing right now, sitting here and discussing Krishna conscious philosophy, just by doing this, we are moving towards liberation. We don't have to go out in the forest and seek liberation. Just by doing this, we are developing our spiritual understanding and increasing our devotional attachment to Krishna. That's how we take liberation. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, please. Would you like to comment something? Yes, please.
We frequently talk about the balancing in spiritual life and material life. But when we start coming to Krishna, we are beginning Krishna consciousness, or when we start coming to Krishna, so we find that we are getting carried away by spiritual things than the material things. So we find much of disinterest in material things. So there is where the question of balancing, we are finding much disinteresting material thing. So if we are working outside, so this is not enough. So how to overcome that?
Good question. So when you come to devotional service, you start becoming disinterested in material life. And how can you continue on material life that way? At a first level, the disinterest in material life is an indication of spiritual advancement. Like we have developed a spiritual text, Krishna described in the Bhagavad Gita. Bhakti, not in Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam is described. Bhakti pareshan bhava virakti ranyantracha. Bhakti leads to para-ish anubhav. Anubhav means experience. Para-ish, transcendental God. So when we experience God, what happens? That experience is so satisfying. Virakti ranyantracha. We become detached from other things. So that is a sign of spiritual advancement. And in that sense, we can be positive about it. At the same time, the spiritual advancement just doesn't come by doing what we like to do. The essence of spiritual advancement is that we become servants of Krishna. And becoming servants of Krishna means doing what is best for our service to Krishna. So, a few devotees may want to become brahmacharis. If that is what they want, then they need to settle their financial obligations, their family responsibilities, and then they can do that. But most people are unlikely to do that. And if one is not going to do that, which is how most people will be, then one, if one is just neglecting one's material responsibilities because one finds devotion more pleasurable, then actually we are bringing the same enjoying mentality to devotion service. Now we are not doing devotion service because it gives Krishna pleasure, but just because it is the easier way to live.
Is it literally the easier way to live?
Okay, but it like involves so much anxiety. I have seen myself, many students, when the exam time comes, the peer is there, suddenly they develop a love for spiritual books.
They have not read spiritual books before, but even when the exam is coming, oh, I don't feel like studying, I want to read these books.
Why?
Because these books are more easy to read and nobody is going to have an exam on these books.
So actually speaking, the path of least resistance is rarely the path of spiritual advancement. So we need to recognize that ultimately my spiritual advancement will come by doing what is best for my self-instruction. So from a long-term point of view, I need to have a stable material life also. So actually speaking, if we are detached from material life, we can do it more responsibly. Because we will not be so emotionally entangled. So we will be able to, okay, this is what I am doing for Krishna's sake. So let me do it. If it works well, but if I don't get so much, it doesn't matter. So actually speaking, the detachment can be used to become more responsible without becoming more emotionally entangled. Yes, I have to do my studies. Actually speaking, if I have my exams, if I am too worried about my results, I can't study properly. But on the other hand, if I understand that I am going to, ultimately Krishna is the controller and he will decide the result. But I have to show Krishna my willingness to serve him and my studies is the way I am going to serve him. So let me do my studies well. So we have I have a devotee friend in Mumbai, here in Mumbai itself. He's a doctor. So he tells how Dr. Bosley, so before he was a medical topper for the first 2.5 years of his career, but he would have taken so many anxiety pills and so much sleeplessness he would have before the exams. After he was introduced to Krishna consciousness, he continued to be a good performer as he was earlier. But he said, I just became free from all the anxiety. Because now I understood that it is not I who am going to determine the result. But I have to know that Krishna will determine the result. So now he's a responsible doctor, he's a warden in one of the colleges here, as a professor. And he's, so actually he felt that he was able to cope with material life with equal, if not more responsibility, but with far less of anxiety. So we need to recognize that this is my duty and this will also lead to my spiritual advancement. So it's not that only coming to the temple and doing devotional activity leads to spiritual advancement. Even our material life, if we're doing it ultimately for Krishna's sake, which is what we are, all of us, once we understand the spiritual purpose of life, then we would like to orient our family life, our career, ultimately as meant for helping our devotion service. So we would like to make our home into a temple. If our home is a temple, then our job is like a fundraising program for our home temple. So it has a transcendental purpose. And then accordingly, we have to orient our life. So we can have that sense of balance. And we shouldn't expect that one formula of balance will work at all times. That is often a problem. So balance is often a dynamic balance. Life doesn't offer a static balance. What is the difference between a static balance and a dynamic balance? Say for example, if I am riding a bike, then if I am moving straight ahead, then the vertical state of the bike is the state of balance. But if I have to turn right, then the vertical state is not the state of balance. The tilted state is the state of balance. But if I have turned right and I still stay in the vertical, tilted state only, what am I going to serve? Isn't it? After I have turned, again I have to be in the vertical state. Then maybe again I have to go straight, again I have to turn it left and then go it forward. So like that, our balance will also be dynamic. That means, say if we are students or if we are working, that sometimes when our life, material life will be very demanding. So at that time, we will just continue our basic spiritual activities. Maybe just chant whatever rounds we are chanting and occasionally come to devotee association at some basic frequency. But other times, when that workload is less, then we shouldn't just waste our time. That time should take as much associate as possible. So, what will be balance will change according to time. Just like sometimes it will be vertical stage, sometimes it will be slightly tilted stage. Sometimes it will be going left, sometimes it will be going right. Sometimes the road is crowded, we go slowly. Sometimes the road is clear, we go fast. Sometimes so many little obligations come in our life that our spiritual journey becomes a little slow. It's fine, it may happen. But then we need to compensate with other times. Generally speaking, in especially the way companies function nowadays, or in colleges, there are certain times when there are projects and there are deadlines. That time you can't do much. But then there are other times when people are on the bench, we have much more freedom. So that time you should utilize it. So ultimately, it's a matter of our sincerity. Vidhani buddhi yogam tan yenama payanti te. Krishna describes in 10 point in the Gita that he will give the intelligence of how we can come towards it. But for that, teshaam satam yuktanam bhajitam priti purvasam. Right? We should try to engage in devotional service with a positive attitude. With a sincere attitude, Krishna, I want to please you. Then we can balance. Krishna will guide us. Okay, this is the time to do this more, this is the time to do this more. But it's very important that we don't have a fragmented view of life. Okay, this is devotional life and this is non-devotional life. But no, we should have that differentiation so that we also give some time for explicit devotional activities. Now if I start thinking, oh, everything, even my job is devotional. So I don't have to come to the temple. We are becoming Sahaji, I know. We have to come to the temple because that gives us explicit reminders of Krishna. And that gives us association and remembrance of Krishna in a very powerful way. So, we need some explicitly spiritual time also. But it is not that after this is over, then my spiritual life is over. No, even my material life can and should be spiritualized as much as possible. So, when we have this vision, then we can do our material duties more responsibly, but with lesser anxiety and lesser emotional entanglement. Does that answer your question? You right,
I'll just repeat what you said, and it was an excellent answer. I just think there's a beautiful prayer from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he said, with one of our great acharyas, who said, "My Lord, I'm keeping this house, but actually it's your house. And I'm keeping this family, but actually they're your family. I'm only caring for them because they belong to you. I'm your maidservant. This house belongs to you, this wife belongs to you, the children belong to you, the money belongs to you. I'm taking expert care of it because it belongs to you." Not that so many people think so we become advanced in spiritual life. I've probably said that the devotee should be daksha, to be expert. So not that you become a devotee and then all of a sudden you're no use to the boss at work. But you become a devotee, so now you're a useless son or a useless student or useless. If you become a devotee, you're a better student. Because instead of smoking and drinking at night at the bars, like many other students do, you're studying attentively. And your mind's more attentive because you chant in the morning, so you're more awake. And you're not, as you described, you're not in so much anxiety because you know I'm going to give results to Krishna. Sometimes I'll be top of the class, sometimes I'll be middle of the class, things are going to change, but I'm doing the best I can for Krishna. So then the balance, as you described, actually is to always to try to make sure it's connected with Krishna. And that, you know, there's another story, maybe it's so common in one's early, but I always think it's funny about the man who's walking on the road carrying the grains, and when he trips and begins to fall, then he yells out, "Open the boat." So he's taking the grains home to eat for himself. But when he trips and they're all going to go in the air and fall on the ground, he'll lose them and quickly offer them to God. So he gets some benefit. So not that we think, you know, okay, you know, actually everything's meant for me, but I'm doing it for Krishna. Krishna, everything's for you. And a big thing for Prahastas is, you mentioned a little bit, is charity. So when we think we should be, you said fundraising program for the house because it's a temple, but also we should try to think 10-20% of our money we should give to Krishna directly, to use, to provide services like this. You know, somebody had to pay for the microphone, somebody's paying for the rent, somebody's paying for the Brahmacharya prasadam. You know, how will they come and teach if we don't offer some support to them? And with your children, you should think like, I have 3 grandchildren now. So, you know, grandfather's role is not so important, but the grandmother, the parents, you know, so you have to take time to make sure the children are Krishna conscious. For the children you love, you put Krishna in the center. You just don't tell them about fairy tales, you tell them Krishna stories. And you don't just have fun with them doing material things, you bring them to the temple and have fun with them that way. So everything becomes Krishnaized. And that way you can keep the balance. And your example of dynamic balance is very important. Because sometimes people get frustrated with that. But it has to be dynamic. At different times you have to put more energy into your job or your studies or your family. At other times you have more freedom to put more time into your seva. So then, as you said, you have to take advantage of that. Krishna is very understanding. And he's very kind. And you also can't trick him. He's more kind than we are, but he's smarter than we are. So he knows what we need. If we're trying our best, he'll appreciate that. Even if we fail, if we try our best for him, then that's success.
Any other questions?
Okay. I'd like to share my experiences also just for 2 minutes. What happened? Actually, I'm able to walk up to 15 fractions. It's a genetic defect. But I was not at all depressed at any point of time in my 38 years of life. But what happened? Last year we changed our residence there. I was staying for 25 years. I was very much emotionally attached to that house. After that, I had a severe depression. I was not able to sleep for 3-4 months. Like, my family members were not ready to give me antidepressant because it may harm my body. Even after taking sleeping pills, I was not able to sleep. But when last month, when I attended the Bhagavad Gita lectures for 4 days, after that, and after chanting the Maya Mantra for 1 round only, I got a sound sleep for 4 to 6 hours. So it was a really miracle which I never believed, because I was very much afraid a person is not able to sleep for 4 months. How will he be able to sleep? But after attending this 4-day session, I was able to sleep. And one thing I would like to say, today also I am not able to forget that house which I sleep for 25 years. I feel that it is the biggest mistake of my life. I feel guilty conscious every time, so I am not able to forget that house. Because I was very much attached to that house. So can you please comment on this? How I will forget slowly and eventually that house which has stayed there for 25 years? Because I was never depressed at any point of time. Even regarding my disability, I was not depressed. Like, so I would like to have an answer from you.
Are you able to sleep nicely?
Yes. I can handle it very well. No problem.
Quite a remarkable thing. So we have a physical home and we also have an emotional home, inner home. So in the Bhagavad Gita in the 12th chapter, Krishna describing the qualities of a devotee, he describes Aniketasthirmate Bhaktimanya Samepriya. So devotee is Aniketaha. Niketan means home. So Aniketa means he has no home. But Sthira Mati. Mati is consciousness there. His consciousness has found the home. It has become steady in Krishna's lotus feet. So actually speaking, for many of us, if our physical home and emotional home are very strongly wedded together, then the relocation to our physical home has emotional. And to some extent that's natural. By the process of bhakti, we develop our emotional home in our remembrance of Krishna, in our relationship with Krishna. So when that happens, when Srila Prabhupada went from Vrindavan to America, there couldn't have been a more radical shifting of a physical residence. Vrindavan was the capital of devotion. Where Srila Prabhupada went to New York, Bowery, that was the capital of degradation. So, it is the most radical shift. But, one day Srila Prabhupada was on a morning walk and he said, Prabhupada, the devotee by mistake took him to some slum area. It is not a very clean place. So, the devotee said, Prabhupada, I'm sorry, you brought him. Prabhupada said, no, this is Vaikuntha. Vaikuntha, they said, what is Vaikuntha? Prabhupada explained to me, Naham Basami Vaikunthe Yoginam Hrudayeshu Yatra-yanti-man-bhakta-tatra-dishkami-narada. So, the Lord Vishnu is telling Narada that I don't reside in Vaikuntha, I don't reside in the heart of the devotees. I am reside where Krishna, where my devotees glorify me. It's a rhetorical statement. Krishna does reside in Vaikuntha, Krishna does reside in the heart of the yogis. But we can't perceive his presence there. When devotees come together and glorify Krishna, and that is the place where we can perceive Krishna's presence. So in the Akintans, when I say this, so Krishna says, this is the place where I reside. So actually, the process of devotional service is meant to help us create a spiritual inner home for ourselves. So by the practice of devotional service, when we start remembering Krishna and sensing Krishna's presence and love in our lives, then wherever we are, it won't matter for us. Because we always feel ourselves in Krishna's shelter. So, if we understand this difference, this physical home, there is an emotional home. And beyond that, of course, there is a spiritual home that we have in Vaikuntha, in relationship with Krishna. So, okay, you could see this change that happened in your life as something which is preparing you to shift your emotional home from the physical location to the spiritual location. So without the devotion, naturally, this separation will cause hurt. But with the practice of devotional service, you can redirect our emotions from the material circumstances to our inner relationship with Krishna. So anikita sthir matir. So while trying to spiritualize, say you can have some kirtans or some, you can yourself regard some verses which you like. And by that, if you start feeling Krishna's presence, then gradually what had happened will not matter so much. So whether it was right or wrong, it's very difficult to decide that. And even if this was wrong, we can't go back and rewrite the past. The past is over. So we can see how we can make the best of what has happened. So one way you can make the best is right now, because the emotional home to some extent is empty, because it is not aligned with the physical home. So rather than trying to go back and realign the two, which is practically not possible, and may not be necessary also, now you can use that emptiness of action that is there in the emotional home to fill that with Krishna. And then once we get a spiritual sense of home, then wherever we go, we have Krishna in the 11th canto. There is an example. And just as a wealthy person, wherever he goes, because he has money, he can enjoy. He can get food, he can get drink, he can get whatever he wants. So similarly, a person who has devotion, wherever he goes, he can enjoy. Because wherever he goes to this part of the world or that part of the world, he can chant, he can talk about Krishna, and he can feel happiness and better. That's an advanced spiritual state, but that can come to all of us if we strive for it. So you can see that change is an opportunity rather than as a mistake. Whatever it was at that time, now it can become an opportunity for you to move forward in your spiritual life. Does it answer your question?
Yes,
ma'am. Would you like to add something to this? Yes. So, we say that name, fame, glory, nothing satisfies like that. On the other hand, it's perishable also. But we feel the need for it in our material life. So, what do we do when we don't get it? So, first thing is that, as we also wonder, our material life is not unimportant. We should let the pendulum swing to two extremes. One is that we make it all important, and the other is we make it unimportant. It's a balanced stage. It is important, but it is not all important. So, in material life, often success is driven by factors which are beyond our control. So therefore, if we worry too much about when success will come and what form it will come, it will only make us insecure and helpless. On the other hand, if we focus on doing what we can do right, then we are also growing internally. We are improving ourselves, we are developing ourselves materially. And success will come gradually. So rather than getting too much worried about when I will get success, we can focus on improving ourselves materially as much as we can, according to our situation, according to our vocation and talents, and success will follow. In material life, the arrival of success and the departure of success, they are unpredictable. But like in sports, like in cricket, they say, form is transient, but class is permanent. Now some batsmen might be in form, some batsmen be out of form. And even the batsman can't control it. But if a person has class, then the person will perform at a reasonable level, not at a dazzling or outstanding level. It will perform at a reasonable level consistently, and sometimes it will be outstanding. So what happens is, if we try to focus too much on transient things, so the transient thing is the success that we get. The steady thing is the class that we enter. So that is permanent. So success will come, success will go. But if we are doing our material life well, then we are improving. There is this anecdotal or allegorical story. There was this person who had gone to a forest. I had written about this in my book, Energy. And while he was walking around the forest, he saw that he came near a mountain peak, mountain slope upwards, foothill of the mountain. And there he saw, suddenly he heard a voice. There's a rock over there. He said, "Push this rock up the hill." So he said, "What is a big rock?" He said, "Push it up there." He said, "Push." He said, "This is God speaking. Push this up the hill." So, non-historical story, but it conveys a very important point. So they started pushing. He said, "God is saying you push it." That was such a huge rock. One day, 2 days, 1 week, 1 month, 6 months he was pushing that. And at the end of it, he said, actually the rock was so big that he couldn't even budge it. And then he finally protested. He said, "God, you knew that I couldn't push this rock up there. Why did the devil do something which I couldn't do?" So when he protested in a very pathetic and emotional way, so again that voice appeared in front of him. "What happened?" He says, "I was unsuccessful." "You told me, what do you mean unsuccessful?" He says, "You told me to push the rock up the hill. I couldn't move it up at all." He said, "What did I tell you?" He said, "You told me to push the rock up the hill." He said, "Yes, who told you to move it?" "What do you mean? What is the use of pushing if you don't move?" He said, "What is the use of pushing?" He said, "Look at your own muscles." Mm-hmm. And he looked and he saw he had a very strong physical muscle. He said, "If I had wanted, I could have moved the rock up myself. But I wanted you to develop the muscles." So in every activity that we do, even in material life, there is internal success and there is external success. So in this case, the external success is moving the rock up there. But the internal success is developing our own physical and internal abilities. So, many times we get too enamored by external success. But external success that comes without internal success, what is internal success? It's a culture of determination, diligence, hard work, systematic planning, development of the necessary skills. All that comprises in internal success. So, even if we get the external success without the internal success, that cannot last for long. On the other hand, if we focus on developing internal success, sooner or later the external success will come. So we need to be patient. We are improving ourselves to the best of our capacity over time, even in material life. Material life, to some extent, it's all about marketing oneself and about one's personality and one's image. But at the end of the day, that and that alone doesn't determine the quality of the work that is done. The quality of the work is determined by the character of the person. So if we are improving ourselves, if we are attaining internal success, we will eventually get external success. So don't let that worry you too much. By the process of practicing Krishna consciousness, we will develop more inner self-mastery, by which we will be able to contribute better and perform better. And the material results will come eventually. Okay? Would you like to add something on this? Yes.
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
The first question is, generally it is said that for each and every question that you got in your life, all those answers are there in Bhagavad Gita.
Okay.
Okay. But when I went to Bhagavad Gita, the very first introduction, it is mentioned in the introduction saying that you shouldn't read Bhagavad Gita expecting a particular answer. You should read it with an open mind. This is what I have read it, that you should always read it with an open mind, not expecting, means you shouldn't expect a particular answer to come from it. But that is on the other hand, generally people say for each and every question you got an answer. Can you please just throw some back on it? So,
the question,
I'm a bit confused.
Should we expect some answers from the Bhagavad Gita, or should we just read with an open mind without expecting any answers? If that is the case, then how do we understand Gita as all answers? See, there are two different points being addressed over here. At a philosophical, conceptual level, it is true that the Gita wisdom provides answers to all of life's questions. Different answers come at different times. Some answers we get on the first reading itself. Some answers we get on mature discussion and realization. Some other answers you may get by over years of practice and realization. So they will get it. It's like in physics. It's not that we get the answers in the first day. You may understand something in the first day, something you have to practice for a long time, calculus also. So that's the first point. The answers are there, you will get different answers at different times. But when we talk about don't look for specific answers, what that essentially means is, don't let certain biases direct our reading of Gita. Means if I am looking in the expectant mode, where is this answer, then there will be so much more wisdom that is there in the Gita that I miss out. So therefore, that is the meaning of having an open mind over there. Instead of the Bhagavad Gita, okay, let me receive whatever wisdom is over there. Let me not let my own preconceptions or pre-questions cause me to filter what I am reading. Okay, this will answer my question is not important. This will answer my question is not important. Some answers are just factual, but some answers, especially in life's deepest questions, they are more like fitting a jigsaw puzzle into a shape. Now, we may have only one part of the jigsaw puzzle, one part which needs to be fitted. But for it to fit, a larger shape has to emerge, then we'll find where it fits. So if we are only constantly looking where this fits, we are not looking how the larger shape is emerging. Then, what will happen? We will never be able to fit it right. So, the Bhagavad Gita offers us a whole worldview. And in English, there is a specific word called Wilton Jong. Wilton Jong is a magnificent, coherent worldview which addresses all of life's questions. So, we need to understand the worldview that is offered by the Bhagavad Gita. And then, our specific question will also fit in. And the answer to it will fit in that worldview. So, that is the two different perspectives. Certainly, our questions will be answered. But the Bhagavad Gita is, maybe a certain background has to be developed before certain questions can be answered. And if we don't get the coherent understanding of the philosophy, then the background will not develop. Apart from that, if we have some specific questions which are burning in our heart and we don't find those answers in the Bhagavad Gita, then we can ask some devotees also about those questions. And on my website, I answer questions in audio. So if devotees ask me questions, I answer them. I already answered around 520 questions over there. 300 questions have already more come just to be answered. So I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Maybe you have some of your questions answered over there already also. The point is that we should be seeking the answer to the specific questions that we have and also be seeking the broader picture of the world with the Bhagavad Gita. And when we understand these two factors have to balance, then we can reconcile these two statements. What is the second question?
Even I read the second thing in Bhagavad Gita only. It is said that a devotee should, he should only, what he should be doing is that he should put himself in this devotional path, saying that it is expected by the God, by the God. Where, and on the other hand, he shouldn't do it because he wants to do it. But he should do it because saying in mind that he wants us to do it. But I think somewhere even we should be taking the first step, isn't it? Like what I got from the phrase is that it should be done because he wants us to do it. Not like you want to do it for him, but you want him to do it for him only. So what I'm saying, shouldn't we be taking on our hands, somewhere we should be taking the first step and then, you know, go on as it is.
Yes, good question. So essentially what you are asking is that we should do everything because Krishna wants us to do it. But then we also have our initiative and our desire. So what is the role of our desire exactly? So in general, the Vedic culture, the Bhagavad's teachings, are taught within a broader Varnashram culture. Varnashram culture has today become distorted into a caste system where people's caste system would have birth. But originally, Guna Karma Vibhagasha, what Krishna described in the Bhagavad Gita, 4th chapter, 13th verse, that it is by birth and, but not by birth, but by work and nature. Guna Karma, qualities and activities. So, in general, see, if a person is of a Brahminical nature, that means the person likes to study and teach. Person of a Vaishya nature, that means the person wants to earn money and then be trading money. So a Brahmana trades in ideas, a Kshatriya trades in people, manages people, controls people, directs people, the king, administrator. A Vaishya trades in money, a Shudra, it's not a value judgmental word, a Shudra basically trades in skills. Artisans and taking care of things basically. So things, money, people, ideas. This is what the different Varnas take care of. So overall, when we say that we should do what Krishna wants, actually Krishna wants us to do what we are naturally have inclined and endowed to. So if I am of a Brahminical nature, I would naturally like to teach and study. So that is why I should do it for Krishna. If my propensity is to trade in money, then I do it for Krishna. So I have a Vaishya for Krishna. So over a period of time, now, because social values are changing so much, and it may not be so easy for us to determine what our propensity is. But over a period of time, we learn, okay, this is what I am good at, and this is what I like to do. Then I do it for Krishna. So when we say that, so if you have these two circles, one is what I want to do. Second is what Krishna wants me to do. So, it's not that these two are non-intersecting circles. They intersect. Among what I want to do, there will be many anti-devotional things. Now I want to enjoy sinful things. That I have to give up. But, there are many things which I want to do which are compatible with devotional service. So, for example, if I have a particular set of skills, if I am good at marketing, then I can do that as a service to Krishna for marketing that externally, and also as a way by which I can earn money and offer the foods to Krishna and also maintain my family household, which is also my devotional service. So we have to find the intersection of these two circles and base our life primarily in that. And gradually we move towards Krishna. So in general, we cannot do too many things which we don't like to do. See, even in devotional life, we'll find that there are certain things which we like more than others. For example, some of them may like kirtan more than classes. Some others may like classes more than kirtans. So there is a basic of all of them which we do. So for example, we hear some philosophy, we chant some around, we participate in kirtan, we take darshan. But then, we can always do the things which we like more. So if I like to study more, then let me do more and more. Like I always have the freedom to do that. So essentially, bhakti doesn't mean we abolish our desires. Rather, we align our desires with Krishna's desires. And Krishna's desires are not one desire. Krishna's desire is an umbrella of desires. And many things in our life we can align with Krishna's desires. So that comes over a period of time by guidance of senior devotees and by understanding the laws of Krishna. Thank you very much for your kind attention and keen questions. We'll continue in the future. You can ask on my website also. We can discuss about it if you want. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki Gaur Premanande. Thank you.